This is the Bigfoot Information Project podcast. Greetings. Greetings and salutations, and welcome to Bibcast number 3. A very special Bibcast recorded live on location near Skookum Meadows in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest in southwestern Washington State. The road to this Bibcast was long and tortured. Originally, I was going to make the trip from Minnesota to downtown Squatchville back in August with friends Jerry, Bob, Paul, and John. Well, one misstep on the 4th of July and a broken fifth metatarsal later found the trip was pushed back to mid-September. Even though Paul and Bob eventually dropped out, the delay proved beneficial since it perfectly aligned with an unrelated trip to the area by a group of researchers including Rick Knoll. This allowed me to pull off a first for the Bibcast, a face-to-face interview. Rick Knoll is one of the best-known investigators in the field today. He's been at it for over 35 years and has collaborated with many of the true giants of Bigfoot research. And those would be figurative giants, of course. Rick's probably best known for his involvement in the expedition that led to the collection of the Skookum Cast, an event which had taken place almost exactly 6 years ago to the day when this interview was conducted. So, on a cool fall night, on the top of a hill overlooking Skookum Meadows and within sight of Mount St. Helens, sitting around a crackling campfire with a circle of friends, I began my conversation with Rick by asking how he originally became interested in Sasquatch.
I was on vacation down in Northern California at a cousin, and my cousin was working on bridges in the Bluff Creek region, and I spent 1 week at his house, and it was really not fun. You know, his wife was kind of odd and would feed us strange stuff, didn't really care for us to be there, so we ate a lot of beans and rice, and that was about it for food. So when my cousin came home and said, "Hey, how would you guys like to go up to where I work?" We said, "Great." So we jumped at the chance. And he took us up to Bluff Creek, and where he was building those bridges there. And we camped on the Klamath River. And my brother and his cousin were with me. And they both wanted to go fishing one day. So they grabbed their fishing poles and their fishing tackle in a little tiny, you know, metal box. Went down to the river and said they wanted to go on the other side, and they were just going to walk across. It looked pretty shallow. So I was the big brother and everything, and I had to stick with my brother. So I grabbed a big axe and started walking across the river with them. My brother got swept down the river and went under, and I freaked out and ran out of the river on the other side, ran down the side of the river, jumped back into the river with this axe and held the handle out till my brother came down, and he got up, grabbed the axe handle, and I pulled him out, and he didn't have a stitch of clothing on him. Everything he just lost everything. And not more than 200 or 300 feet down the river was a waterfall. And so when we finally made it back, we walked back up and over on the bridge. I had nightmares for, you know, a couple days, and then everybody started talking to me, trying to get my mind off of it, and they started telling me Bigfoot stories. And I think it sort of was just psychologically imprinted on my brain to be interested in it. That's the only thing I can think of how I got into it.
How old are you then?
I'm 53.
Then how old are you? I can't do math.
I'm sorry. that was my last year of high school, so...
17.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever heard that... Have you ever had an encounter or an experience or a sighting?
I've seen a couple of things that are strange. One time I was... I went and visited John Green, and we were up in Harrison Hot Springs, and Thomas Steinberg was up there, and so was a guy by the name of John Miles. And John was driving a little truck in front of me, not a truck, it was like a Jeep, a Suzuki or something like that. And it was raining out, and it was really dark, and we got to this spot where there was a famous incident that happened there where a bus driver claimed to have seen a Bigfoot cross in front of him, and he had passengers and everything, and they got out, and he saw the steam coming out of the nostrils, and it turned out to be some guy in a costume trying to fake everybody out. And we were right at that spot, and John Miles was driving in front of me, and it was raining, and it was dark, and you know how your headlights don't go all the way up. And something crossed in front of me, and it was on hairy, it was all hairy, and it looked like two legs. And it took only two steps to go across that road. And I blinked, and I shook my head, thinking, what was that? Was that just the rain coming down in that pattern? A bear or what? So I slammed on the brakes, and I had a CB, and I called John. He stopped, backed up. We got out in the rain and started searching around. I had flashlights, and we didn't see anything, but that's probably the only thing that I could say that, you know, might possibly have been a Bigfoot.
Right now, we're in Washington State. We're in the southwestern corner of Washington State. We're in Gifford Pinchot, near Skookum Meadow, and we're sitting up on a hill call blasting tonight. How often do you find yourself coming out? I mean, and this is we're at the tail end of a kind of a larger event. What's it, if Rick's going out? What is a typical, you know, excursion look like? I mean, you're going out for a week, a weekend? You go out for an afternoon?
Well, people, I get phone calls, and they tell me that they heard something up in a certain area, or that they saw something, and I'll just leave from work and go up there, and if it warrants staying longer, then I'll come home, get a camper, and head out. But in a month, I'm usually out at least twice, and my vacations... yearly, I spend doing this. Now I've sort of extended my vacations, so I take like 3 weeks without pay to go out and do active research. So I'm out quite often, I think.
It's got to be it's a huge expense. I mean, you're doing this pretty much out of your own pocket. I mean, what drives you to do it? What keeps you doing it all these years?
Well, like I said, I think when I was young, it replaced a very stressful psychological event in my youth. And so that's the only thing I can think of why I'm so interested in it. I'm not interested in anything other than that. I mean, most of the things I do is for photography. I love to do photography. So I've dove with sharks. I've gone to really strange places in the world. And it's all been about getting pictures.
How would you gauge success? Is that it? Do you want a photo? A good photo someday?
No, I don't think a photo would be enough. It would be enough for me, but I would like to be able to develop a method where I can bring almost anybody to an area and say, we'll have an encounter with one of these animals. That's, you know, that would be the ultimate. But then on the other hand, I often think, I go, what is it exactly I'm doing here? Am I trying to get this animal in a zoo finally, or am I wanting to just prove to myself something that, like you said, I've been spending all this money on? I don't really know.
Well, everyone needs a hobby, right?
Yeah, I would say this is, I guess, yeah, there's a lot worse hobbies.
Yeah, I mean, look at where we are. It's gorgeous out here. You could be, I don't know, collecting stamps or something.
Gambling too.
Yeah, that's true. I would say that you're one of the better known names in this field today, and not just within this field, but without this. I mean, we were talking earlier in the week about being on radio shows on a regular basis and that sort of thing. How does this impact your life? I mean, what do your employers think? What do your friends say? I mean, do you have friends that aren't out here in the woods? I mean, how does this impact your life?
Well, I guess a lot of people don't know what I do for a living. I work in the aircraft industry, and I operate some sophisticated equipment, and I am always on a computer. I measure things with lasers and optics, and it's tied into a computer, and figure out 3D coordinates on things and place things very accurately on other things. And at first, people were like, you know, what the heck is this guy talking about? You know, that's the guy that hunts Bigfoot. So I would come back. And my computer would have a cardboard cut out of Hollywood on it, or it would have, you know, they'd make these wooden feet in the snow and traipse around my truck. They would, let me see, what else have they done? Oh, they made a clay figure of 2 feet and pinched them in one of the drawers, so it looked like I had a dead Bigfoot in my computer drawer. You know, they played practical jokes and stuff like that, but... it's really surprising. A lot of them want to go out with me. And in fact, 2 days from now, we're going to be out on a boat down here at Swift Creek Reservoir. And one of the guys at my work was call blasting there, and we're going to recreate what he did. We call blasted, and he found tracks the next day where the return calls came from. And so he's gotten the bug, sort of. He's gone out with me a couple of times. I've taken him up pretty high up in the mountains in the snow, plowing through with my my truck, and he thought it was really cool. But he's sort of like John over there. He always wears shorts. He never gets out of the truck when we get up there. So I don't.
That sounds pretty cool from a warm cab of a truck.
Yeah.
The Swift Creek Reservoir. That's an instance where someone was call blasting from a boat in the middle of the reservoir.
Yeah. We decided we wanted to get a bigger echo. We wanted to hear it a long ways away, and we figured that, you know, over a lake that had some cliffs, that it would go, you know, 7 miles away from us, hit the cliff and bounce up in the air, just cover a great distance. And sure enough, it did work. But we also we had a lot of campers, you know, on the side over there that were going, what the f*** was that? You know, that was sort of strange. And then we also went over to this island. There was, you know, there's certain times of the year, even up here in Washington, where you can't burn. It's just too dry. And these guys were over there behind an island hiding so that on the main road on the opposite side of the lake, you couldn't see their fire. And we were over there. We had night vision and everything. We were seeing some pretty strange things that those guys were doing over there. I don't know exactly. But anyway, they didn't like the call blasting either.
The thing that strikes me about call blasting is that we don't really know what we're blasting. I mean, to a certain extent, we're not even sure that what we're blasting is Bigfoot. We don't know what we're saying. Do you find it's a useful technique? Do you get returns? Do you get returns that sound like the things that you're blasting?
The only time I've gotten returns was on the Skookum expedition. And I've only call blast, even though I have my own call blaster, I've only tried it, you know, half a dozen times. Most of the time I go out and look for tracks. I have specific places that I look. I always look for... I have a geological map of Washington, and it identifies clay deposits that are on the surface, and that's very important, I think. And then
why do you think that's important?
Well, that gets into the diet of an animal. I believe that if this animal lives in the Pacific Northwest, it's going to utilize ferns, nettles, things that are... a little dangerous to eat, uncomfortable to eat, maybe even not even digestible unless there's something that will affect the characteristics of that food source. And so if they eat clay along with it, it'll settle their stomach, or if they process the food differently than just eating it raw like an elk or a deer or a bear would eat, that they would be able to utilize it. Nettles, like gorillas, nettles... you know, they sting. And if it got down into your stomach before the acids would hit, it could burn your esophagus. You would not be able to digest that very easily. So they roll it up before they eat it. So all the stinging part is on the inside. When it gets down in the stomach, the acid neutralizes it or burns it out or something. Well, clay is sort of like the same thing. And it's also where we get kaopectic. Another thing that we use to settle our stomachs when we eat stuff that doesn't digest very easily or it gives us problems. Now, ferns, most of the ferns are like deadly poison. You can boil some and make some tea and like fiddleheads and stuff like that, but the bracken ferns and stuff I think it attacks your liver, and you don't want to eat those.
But keep that in mind.
Yeah. But gorillas eat them. So how do they do it? The researchers over in Africa and that found that they were doing, I think it's called geoflagy, where they eat soils to counteract some of those poisons.
What?
I look for clay.
What strikes me about your approach is that it's... there's a holistic quality to the way you approach this. You approach it from different angles and vectors. I mean, you're talking about taking what gorillas are doing in Africa and trying to adapt that to the geology and the climate here in Washington State. How much of what you do is researching things that on the surface may not seem related, and how do you make those connections?
Well, I don't want to say that I put myself or my brain inside of a Sasquatch, but you gotta try and think of how an animal like that would live here. Where would it live? How would it live? How would it eat? What it would do in certain circumstances? And then you just look at other animals, the strategies that they use to live by, and see if there's anything that would be applicable. John Bindernagel wrote a book, an excellent book on the subject, where he took all the reports and itemized out different things, characteristics or attributes or whatever you want to call them, of each of the reports, and then tried to look in the primate world to see if there was anything that was similar. And I've been doing that for a long time. It's just, he's the first person to ever actually spell it all out in a book so everybody can see that there's everything is a lot more complex than what we think. Everything is related. There's reasons why animals, they all have a brain, of course, so they have not emotions, but they do things that if you had two clone deers standing side by side and they were presented with some sort of circumstance that they had to make a decision, they're not going to do the same thing. They're going to do two opposite things or two different things. And so there's a difference between, just like in humans, there's a difference between one person and another, what they think they're going to do or what they do do. That's the one variable I can never guess at, actually, and with any accuracy. The other things just get you prepared. Get you prepared to find evidence. When I talk about the soils and the food out there, I go to those areas where those are, fully prepared to find something. And if I don't find something, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that either these things are that rare, I was there in the wrong time, or I'm just completely wrong. I don't know which, but sometimes I do find stuff, sometimes I don't. I mean, I go on rivers and I actually look at the river for the different soil conditions for tracking. And I find that, down lower, closer to the coast, the sand grains are a lot coarser than further up. And it changes every year. The rivers change every year. And so you can make a map, although I don't usually make a map. I just go to one of these river rafting places. They make a map every year anyway. And they identify all these different sandbanks and stuff, and those are the areas that I go and visit. So it's I don't know if that answered the question.
No, I think that answered the question well. Yeah. As I said a second ago, we're near Skookum Meadows. Do you think this is this one of the more active spots in this part of the country, or is this just is it a great place to come because it's accessible and moderately active?
Well, depends on how you define active. If you define active by, you know, these reports, I think you're looking more at what humans are doing. Let's say you got two identical areas, and in one you have a very good camping area, there's good recreation, stuff like that. There's a lot of people there, right? Say both areas have the same amount of Sasquatch in them, or the same amount of deer, or the same amount of wolverines, whatever. The one with the more people are going to make the more reports of seeing them. So that's one of the factors that you have to bring in. And why I'm saying that is because I think there's a lot of areas. You just look at the habitat. There's no bad area that I know of, except for ones that don't have water, shelter, or food. If you have those three, then you could have any type of animal that exists anywhere else. So to say Skookum or Mount St. Helens area is more active than, somewhere over on the Olympic Peninsula, I don't think that's true. I think the Olympic Peninsula has much more potential because it's so less populated with people, and there's a lot more shelter there than here.
What kind of shelter?
By shelter, I mean there's less roads, so that you don't have a lot of human influence going into an area, that they can travel in distance, even straight lines, and not have to cross a road and the potential of being seen. There's places for them to seek shelter from the elements, maybe underneath a tree or like a bear, a down tree, dig underneath, make a little enclosure down in there. I don't know exactly where they would live, you know. I don't think they live up in trees. Maybe the young ones might climb a tree, I don't know. But they're pretty big, you know. It would be hard to hide unless there was not really a reason to hide. Yeah. And so if you're in an area where you don't really have to hide, it would be easier and less stressful on the animal.
Do you think that a Sasquatch is a Sasquatch, so that what Patterson and Gimlin saw in California is similar to what they might see here, or what they might see in Idaho or Montana or even Texas or Florida for that matter? Or do you think that there's differences in these animals? Do you have enough information to make some sort of determination that way?
I would sooner believe that the difference in reports about the description of these animals is about the animal than the actual person reporting it. So by that I mean, I think that everybody that sees something, they observe it slightly different than the next person. And we are interpreting what their brain interpreted what they saw. And so, you know, what Patterson and Gimlin put on film is not an observation. It is something that everybody can see for themselves and interpret. All these reports might be slightly tainted by emotions, by past history, by what they were doing 5 minutes beforehand, or by what part of the eye they were looking at it. I don't know, but I just cannot believe that we have one of these large primates living amongst us, and in each state they're a little bit different. I mean, that's hard to believe. You look at how many deer we have, and you go from this coast to the other coast, we have a slight difference, but we don't have one for every single state, you know.
So California deer are a lot different than the Oregon deer, from what I understand.
Mind if I call?
No, we'll be right back after this short call blasting break.
The day before my conversation with Rick, a cold, wet, and otherwise grumpy troop of Bigfoot researchers scrambled down a steep hillside, through thick underbrush, and over rain-slicked fallen trees in order to make their way into Skookum Meadow. Their mission was to set a few camera traps and look for signs of elk. Despite its name, the famous cast was not collected in the meadows themselves, but about a half a mile away in a wide spot on a forest road. The environment of the meadow consisted of a large area of thigh-high grass that squeaked as we walked through it, dotted with thickets of mossy pine trees and crisscrossed with little creeks you couldn't see until you were right on top of them. Evidence of elk was abundant. I was able to tag along and conduct an impromptu Q&A session regarding the Skookum cast and Rick's experience with the area and its wildlife.
Right now we're in the middle of Skookum Meadows, and we just are sitting in the rain waiting for a cast to dry.
What did you think we cast here?
Well, there's been some talk about the Skookum cast being an elk, and so we came down to a wallow, an elk wallow. Of course, this time of year, the wallow, all the grass starts growing up, and so it doesn't really look like a wallow, but the impressions are still there. So we found a wrist joint and a hoof and another hoof for where it stood up, and we've cast it. We're waiting for it to cure.
Okay. Now, this time of year, the what I'm looking at here is, it looked like it was a big muddy pit at one point, but now there's a bunch of grass growing up in it. And so what you're saying is that this is not ideal wallow conditions for an elk. I wouldn't be wallowing here if I was an elk right now.
Right now, the elk wouldn't be wallowing. It's just the wrong time of year. And if there's grass in here, it'd be all chewed up. They would... They'd first eat it, yeah, and then their hooves, and they'd start digging pine, and then they would urinate, defecate in it, and roll around in it, and that's a sexual attractant.
Okay. So are they doing that prior to mating, or is that something they just do?
It's part of the rut, so yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, that's one of the things that is sort of in favor of the Skookum cast, is that the time of the year you found it was about this time of the year. It was late September, and it's just not the time that they're doing that. And I would imagine up there near where the cast was found are they doing this sort of activity up there any time of the year?
No. See, in Skookum Meadows, it's protected. The animals know where they can go, and they've never been threatened. So they retreat. This is like the core of their home range. And when they go out of this, they know the boundaries. When they pass through those boundaries, they know that they're taking a risk the further away they get from this safe area. So they don't do things like what they do here. They won't wallow around out there, especially in hunting season.
Sure. So wallowing is sort of a comfort kind of activity for them. I mean, they're going to do that where they feel safe.
It's a mating thing. Okay. Yeah.
It's absolutely beautiful down here, and obviously there's not a lot of activity of humankind, because I don't see a lot of evidence of people down here. It was hard getting down here. Is there an easier access point to this area than the one we used, or is that pretty much it?
Nope.
Okay. Awesome.
It is hard to get down here. And, it's easier in the summertime. But in the conditions in the summer, you only find certain spots that are wet and where there's good tracking conditions. Normally, when I look and find a track out here, like a Sasquatch track or something, and it has grass, I would have a small little propane torch that you buy at like Radio Shack for $3, and you'd burn that grass out. But we're shooting a TV show, so we're not really doing that. This specific task right now is to look for something to compare to the Skookum cast that we know came from an elk.
Right.
And that's the purpose of casting right here, right now.
Okay. And if we wanted to get a cast of an entire wallow, we would have to be here earlier in the year. I mean, this is not
definitely early in the year.
Okay. All right. You've been down here, I mean, how many times do you think you've been down here? You've been down here a lot.
Mount St. Helens area?
Yeah. Well, this meadow down here, the Skookum Meadows.
Well, I never came to Skookum Meadows before 99, I think.
Okay.
In Mount St. Helens, I've been here I've guided a few Sasquatch expeditions up on Mount St. Helens in 75, I think.
So you've been coming up here. That was before the eruption, of course. So yeah. Have you been down here at all times of the year? Have you observed this area in the spring, in the summer, the fall? Have you been here in the winter?
Yeah. I have to stay at the snow park, which is down below us, about 1,000 feet. And I haven't snowmobiled in, but I've used snowshoes to get in. I like it in the snow. I stay warmer in the snow than in the rain, of course. And the tracking conditions are just as good in the snow as it is here. Now, the trick is how do you get a cast out of snow?
Yeah, you can cast in snow?
Oh, yeah. 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 Hydrocal doesn't heat up that much if you do it the way I cast, which is a thin eggshell layer first, and just let that sort of kick so that it will support the weight of the thicker stuff underneath, on top. If you just pour it all in there, it's going to heat up and just melt right through. Right. And I also put a little bit of potassium sulfate in it, and that prevents the water that I mixed with from freezing if it's really cold. You can also use a spray wax. That's something that the police use. It's a red spray, and you spray it about 4 or 5 times, and it makes like a coating over it and insulator so that the wet material, the plaster, doesn't start seeping through. Because snow isn't like ice. It's got air and stuff like that, and holes and stuff, and the stuff will just go down in.
So is there a time of the year where you've not found indication of Bigfoot activity down here, or is it your opinion that they're here all the time, or do they come through here seasonally, or can you tell?
You know, every time I've come down here, I've found something, whether it's on the side of a road or just out in the woods, or heard something, like the screams that we call blast with. I've smelt a couple of things that I've never smelt before. I haven't seen anything that I would say is a Sasquatch. I've seen some shadows move and stuff like that, but I'm not one to really, you know, jump the gun on something like that.
Turns out the only thing harder than going down a wet, overgrown forested hill is going back up, especially when the meager game trail we followed on the way down was invisible when heading in the opposite direction. When I got back to camp, every part of me not covered by my rain poncho was soaking wet, and every other bit of me was freezing cold. But it was worth it, and the next day, when someone needed a volunteer to help gather up the game cams, I was there. It's not every day you get a chance to venture into a place like Skookum Meadows.
A second ago we were talking about the PG film. What's your take on that? Do you think that's the real deal, or do you think there's a little bit of uncertainty in your mind?
There's no uncertainty in my mind about the Patterson film. I think that, you know, anybody that's in this right now are going to make the same mistakes that Roger Patterson made in not knowing the exact place or recording the exact place of where it was developed. You know, all the little inconsistencies that people have found, anybody in this field right now are going to have the same. And I think it's been proven out time and time again. You know, someone comes up with tracks and they start talking about, well, it doesn't look like a track because of this or that. And nobody is perfect, and we're not getting professional. Even the professionals that go out, CSI, police, they make mistakes. They cover it up and get it by in a courtroom. They do have to cover up things that they forgot, that they made a mistake in the field. They forgot to do this, or they didn't document this really well. It's the same thing. We're humans. So I think that the Patterson film, we had a couple of humans behind that camera. It wasn't one of these automatic cameras that prints the date and time.
It's 40 years now almost. And it's unrepeated. Why do you think it's not been repeated in 40 years?
Well, I'm going to hand it to Roger Patterson. He may have been not the most up and up person, but I tell you, he had a lot of good ideas. I mean, from my understanding, he was the first person ever attempted call blasting. He's the person that came up with some of the best tracks at the very beginning. He took a movie camera out in the field, a professional one, 16 millimeter. He practiced with it. He knew how to use it. He used horses, and he spent a great deal of time out there. He had the bug. So I think one of the things is that he couldn't hold a regular job for various reasons, and he had that spare time, and that's what he did.
You know, it's interesting. It just occurs to me as you're saying that he didn't just walk the forest roads where tracks are being found. He went into the woods with those horses, with Bob. But he put himself where the monkeys were, you know, so to speak. Not where it was easy to do the job.
Yeah, that's true.
You do that. How many other researchers do you know that are doing that? Why not?
Well, it's a lot easier not going in the woods. It's a lot easier just to sit in a car on the side of the road and hook up your call blaster to the car battery or peek out the window with a starlight vision. I've always maintained that most of the sightings and most of the reports are mistakes on the part of the Sasquatch. They have made a mistake being seen. The best way to encounter an animal is to confront it. It's not really confronting, it's competing. You compete with an animal, and you're going to run into it. If I went out and I wanted to see a bear, the best way to go and see a bear is to visit where it eats. So go to a berry field. In berry season, you've got a greater chance of seeing a bear. Not as great as going to the zoo, but the best chance of seeing a bear is going to a berry field. In Alaska, it's going to a river where there's fish.
Sure. Of course, I will say, around my house, if I want to see a raccoon, I just can hang out by my trash cans and they'll show up sooner or later. Which is sort of the same as just sitting by the side of the road. In all the years you've been doing this, is there a particular report or a series of reports or an incident that sticks in your mind, something that you yourself researched or helped bring to light?
Well, there's a lot.
I'll just pick 50 or 60 of them.
There's been some really cool ones that turned out to be duds, and there's been some really bad ones that turned out to be really good in the end. I was in California, and I had to have Owen go and investigate it, but there was a couple of gentlemen up in Walker Valley, which is north of Seattle. And it is actually part of our study area where we believe that the animals are traveling east and west during the summer, winter, fall, and spring. And this was at the winter, so it comes down from all the heavy snow and everything, gets closer to human habitation. And it came onto this person's property, walked up onto a porch that had an overhang that was, I think it was 7 feet tall, the overhang, and bumped its head, and then bumped its head against a light bulb and broke it, and left blood on the light bulb onto the porch in the snow, and got mad and pushed over a refrigerator and stomped out of the yard, leaving these big deep footprints. And Owen collected the blood sample, took pictures and their information, and sent it to Todd Distel. And he analyzed it and said the DNA from that was so similar that he couldn't tell the difference between it and Jane Goodall's. And the reason he said Jane Goodall is because Jane Goodall was the last DNA that he tested.
Did she have an alibi for that night?
That's a good question. But it does bring up a fact, well, not a fact, but it brings up something interesting. Maybe these things aren't, with DNA, are not so discernible between us and them that we don't have the primers yet to really see the difference between the DNAs. I'm sure that if we had no knowledge of chimpanzees and one came up on a porch and broke its head,
sure,
on a light bulb and left some blood and it was tested, and the guys, you know, they, yeah, tested the DNA, it'd be so close to human that they just say it was human, right?
Right.
Same thing.
What's your take on feeling towards the morality of killing one of these? You know the arguments in pro and against. Where do you stand on that?
At one time, I thought I was going to kill one,
And that was early on. That was early on, 78. I bought a pistol that was a 45-70 Thompson Contender, and I sighted it in. You know, it's like not a very short-range pistol, but a 45-70 is the same round that goes into a Gatling gun or a 45 sharp Buffalo rifle. It's pretty powerful, but it's very short distance. Matter of fact, the ballistics of it almost describes a circle or part of a circle. You know, it just goes up and down. And it has a scope on it and everything. I was fully prepared. But the more I thought of it, I'm going, well, these things aren't hurting anything. And I've gone to the zoo and I've looked at the gorillas. I go to the zoo quite often to look at the gorillas, and they just seem so sad in there that I really don't know when it happened, but I decided that if I ever saw a Sasquatch or was able to get pictures of it, I'd be really reluctant to turn it over to science.
So I think we would be suspicious if one day Rick just stopped going out.
What would happen is that I would stop. Yeah. Well, I'd stop with the Bigfoot community. I'd still go out because I'd like to probably see him again, but I probably wouldn't want to give everybody the opportunity to go out and shoot one.
I guess it gets back to why one does this. What's the motivation? And if the motivation is to bring it to science, then obviously then you want to kill one. But if that's not your motivation, then that's maybe not what you want to do.
Yeah, you know, I talked extensively with Grover Krantz about that, and he firmly believed, you know, to shoot it is to protect it. But, you know, he was a physical anthropologist. I think he just wanted the bones. You know, he had a lot of bones in his garage or his workshop or whatever he wanted to call it. It was a garage, but he converted it. And it looked like the head, you know, shaman in a village in Indonesia that was full of heads. You know, it looked like a headhunter's hut. You know, there was just so many skulls in there. And he would probably really love to have that skull, or the bones of one. But I don't know of any cultural anthropologist that's really looked at this and said, "Nah, I'm more interested in something else." You know, the behavior, the ecological niche that it's living in, and stuff like that. They're more interested in the living creature than the dead one. They could say the same thing. If we found a new animal on another planet, we're not going to go there to kill it to come back and prove that it exists. We're going to go there and study it with video, you know, pictures. Same thing. I think it's the old style of, you know, when Darwin went out, when Wallace went out and explored the Galapagos or Malaysia. Each day they must have shot, you know, dozens and dozens of animals, the same animal, to see the variations, and just packed them up in crates and sent them back to England. I think those days are gone, but there's still a lot of people that believe that they'd like to do that.
Do you find yourself in a position nowadays where you're trying to convince someone that this animal is real?
No. Uh-oh.
Well, so much for my follow-up question then.
Only one radio station has ever really, you know, tried to get me to prove to them that it existed, you know, and it was just a setup. They were just trying to make a joke out of it, and I just pass it off, you know, as a joke. Most places, most people that come to talk to me about Bigfoot, they already think that there's something going on. And I don't think they think I'm crazy for doing it. They just think it's interesting that someone would do that. And I think I have pretty logical reasons behind how I do it and what I do and why I do it. And I think it's a healthy exercise. I'm not hurting anybody.
What do you think makes the case the best of all the things that have been collected and seen and recorded and so on and so on? I mean, what's the what is the thing that it, that makes the case the best?
When you see your first track. When you see your first track, if you haven't seen the animal, that just keeps you going. I don't know what it's like if you see your first animal, because I haven't done that. I can't say anything about the Patterson film. I can't say anything about the Skookum cast or about all the reports. I've talked to, you know, hundreds of people about their sightings. Each one's slightly different. Each one lasts only a few seconds. They're scared to death. They don't want to be around it. I was on this one. I went up to Twisp. I was working with Peter Byrne, and he gave me a call and said, go up to Twisp. It's up near the Canadian border in Washington, outside of Winthrop. And it was like 15 below. There was a lot of snow. And there was a packer up there. A packer is someone that has horses and mules and guides people, hunters, and whoever wants to go deep into the woods and not have to walk. They can ride horses, and all their gear will go with it. Well, this packer lived there. He had two, I wouldn't really call them houses, but they, I guess he called them that. And in one of them, he was with his wife, and he fell asleep on his easy chair. And this is like a square house. And there was one little section where there's a wall and a door. That was their bedroom. The kitchen, living room, and I guess it wasn't really a dining room. It was like a stove room. They had a wood stove there to heat up. He fell asleep there. His wife heard a clunk and a clang on the back porch. And she opened up the door, or she walked over to the door and listened and heard something moving around out there. She woke up her husband. Her husband said, well, I'll go take a look. Got up, walked to the back door, opened it up, and had to look up from a hairy chest up to the face of a Bigfoot, not 3 inches away from his. He slammed the door, ran into the bedroom. The wife is screaming, going nuts in there. He grabbed his shotgun, walked back out reluctantly, and got on the porch, and the animal was gone. What he saw was footprints leading over to where he knew there was a spring, but there was 2 feet of snow. And it had dug up the spring and broke through the ice and must have been thirsty. Then he looked over on this table, because it was 15 below and they didn't have electricity. It was all gas. He had a big wash tub, you know, with the little lip that goes around. It's galvanized steel. And it had lifted it up. And there was poor boy sandwiches in wrappers that were being stored in there, and they were frozen, solid, because it was so cold. And this thing grabbed one of those, walked out to the into the yard towards the spring, ripped open the wrapper, and took the poor boy sandwich. And then the tracks came back around their car and disappeared on the frozen road. So it's things like that, stories like that, that... you know, this guy was serious. He was scared to death. That just make you keep on going. There's something going on there. That was the question.
Doesn't matter. It's a good story. How do you find encounters like that change the people or the lives of the people who have them?
I don't know. They died.
Well, that's pretty serious, isn't it? Scared them to death.
Yeah, their family members, years later, started becoming interested in Bigfoot, and they came on to, I guess, the Bigfoot forums, and was actually posting stuff, and they wanted information from me about that, because their parents didn't give it to them before they died. So,
do you find that... those people specifically, or other people in general, I mean, do you keep in contact with them? Do you find that in some way it's a event in their lives that changes them? Or do you think people just kind of go back to their routine and it's just a fun story to tell when they go camping with their friends?
Most people go back to the same routine that they had before the encounter. A few of them become Sasquatch researchers. But the majority of them, they just go back.
All right.
At least that's what's happened to me.
Yeah, sure. I have a hard time understanding how like, well, the story you just told, this guy lives out there in the middle of nowhere, and one day he opens up his back porch, and there's, you know, this giant thing standing out there, and I would at least, you know, I'd probably move to the city after that. I don't know.
Yeah. You might, yeah.
Or at least get electricity or something. Do you prefer the term Bigfoot or the term Sasquatch?
Well, this is an either-or one, huh? I would prefer Sasquatch, but the trouble with Sasquatch is it's been anglicized also from an Indian name. Bigfoot is more... It sort of identifies only one part of the body. Yeah. Of course, the most common thing about Bigfoot is its tracks. So I guess in a way that Bigfoot identifies the phenomenon and Sasquatch identifies the animal.
What's the plural of Bigfoot?
The plural of Bigfoot? Oh, shit.
As our supply of firewood started to dwindle, our conversation turned to what criteria Rick uses when looking for areas in which to perform research, and what his research has led him to infer regarding likely Sasquatch habitat. After that, I opened up the conversation to some of the others sharing our fire.
Yeah, I don't really look for areas that got names like that, like wilderness or this or that. And I also don't respect the boundaries of the states or even the countries. I think more in the terms of watersheds. Yeah. And watersheds are not even related to counties even. There's watersheds that will cover three counties or three states. And those watersheds are very important in this type of a study because if you concentrate on one area and know everything that's in that area, what kind of animals are there, their travel routes, you know, where tracks can be found, where things browse, where things eat, where things die, where things sleep, where they mate, you get a sense of when something is not right when you're there. And then you can hone in on something that isn't normally there. And maybe that is related to Bigfoot. I don't know. If you find some tracks there, yeah, it might be related to Bigfoot. But that's how I do my research, is identify a watershed and then try and concentrate on that watershed. And on Giganto, the show started out... Jeff Meldrum wanted to do an expedition, and he chose Owen Caddy's and mine, our research area that we've been working for quite a while. And the other trouble with identifying a research area is that you let other people know where this is, and they see that you are having luck or you're not having luck. And if you are having luck, they want to visit that same spot. And when they do, they might come across some tracks or they might not. But they're looking at this the same way they always do. And that negative information is just as important as the positive information. That you don't go in July to find tracks, you go in April. So everybody that is going up in July, if they're all not finding tracks, it'd be nice to be in our books saying that that even adds more evidence that nothing's happening in July. But we don't get that because... nobody's talking to one another. There isn't one global database where all this information is going in. And the database has to be so huge, you know, it can't just have Sasquatch-related material. It has to have things that, like I said, soil, weather, fires, forest fires, I think are really important because it opens up areas for other wildlife. Then you got birth times. You got maybe symbiotic relationships with other animals. There's a whole bunch of stuff that people that are researching Bigfoot could get into, and I think it would really help further the cause instead of just going out and looking for tracks or looking for the animal.
In your research area, I think you mentioned a little while ago that that you think they're moving through there. Do you think that is that migration, or are they just ranging over a home territory, or how would you describe that?
from what I've seen in our study area over the years, we believe that there are certain valleys that they would go up into and spend most of their time, and when they want some serious water or serious food, high protein for some reason, like steelhead or something, they'll come down out of those valleys that don't have roads, trails, very, very remote and rugged. They'll just browse up in there. And I think that the valleys have to have an east and a west face so they can sun themselves or cool themselves. The north and south don't work as well. And I believe that when you look at the weather, certain parts of the country have more extreme weather than others, that they will travel from that extreme level of weather to a place that is more moderate. And so up in the high country, when it's almost impossible to live, they'll come down lower, closer to humans. And I don't think it has anything to do with, you know, Halloween or something like that, you know. But, you know, like my favorite time to go out is this time of year, September, October, November. You know, and I go snowshoeing and looking for tracks in the snow as well. I just don't find them as easily because when you're so low to the ground, you can't see that well. So recently I've been using airplanes and helicopters and flying over, and you can, in the right light, you can see tracks even from up there.
And if conditions are correct, they could a track in the snow can last quite a while.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's been a lot of tracks found in snow, and they're just not identifiable. There's some tricks with snow. You can, you know, brush it all away, and anything that stomped on that snow, because it's mostly air, will compact it underneath there, and you might get a better look at what made it if you dig it away, but not usually.
You're mentioning Owen Caddy, who's working your regular research area with you. How important do you think is his background to the work that you've done? What sort of insights has he brought?
Well, for the other primates, he's been invaluable. He's got firsthand knowledge of a chimpanzee family that went nocturnal. He's told me some very interesting story. He was over in Africa. He was living in a little cabana, and he was sitting on his veranda thing there, and he had a barbecue set out there, and it had, you know, those dangling utensils that everybody wants to pick up their burgers and stuff with, you know, shiny, and the sun was glinting off of it, and he was writing, and he noticed that everything got quiet, and then he heard some rustling in back of him. He turned around and looked, and there was a troop of chimpanzees just mesmerized by the glinting sun off of these walking towards him, and he just watched it for a few minutes, and then the wind stopped, and they stopped doing that, and they just took off. Yeah, it sort of reminds me of when Joe Bilart decided he was going to string up CDs out in the woods. And I thought, wow, that's pretty strange. But when Owen told me that story, I go, well, I guess maybe that will work.
Any other questions from the gallery?
I know you'll paraphrase it, but when you were talking about how you find a place to focus on, do you look at maps and look for strange names? Like, I notice not only is Skookum Meadow here, and Skookum means a lot of different things in Indian, crazy, one of them, there's a Crazy Hills just south of us. Was that something else that made you focus on this?
You know, that was so good, I'm just going to leave that in there just the way it is.
Well, place names. I think it's interesting that, you know, First Nation tribal members have gotten names for these animals attached to land masses. I don't know what to make of that, because originally I thought that a lot of the stories were just to keep children in line. But when they assign, you know, a land mass or some sort of land feature with one of these names, it takes on a different dimension, and it's kind of interesting. Yeah, my understanding was Skookum has always meant powerful, Yeah, but the Crazy Hills, I don't know where it got that name. But that isn't an Indian name. There's a lot of other places that have some interesting names. The Press Expedition, when it crossed over Terra Incognito, which is the Olympic Peninsula, or is now, it was Terra Incognito. That was the heyday of expeditions, I think, is when newspapers, wanting to get a serialized account of something stupendous, would gather up doctors and lawyers and just, you know, the general affluent adventurers and say, hey, look, we're going to go on this expedition, cross over here, write about it, send it back on horseback to us. Well, they found some places over there that were pretty spooky that I haven't heard anybody talk about since. And it's kind of weird, but they had the same sort of names. They had, I think it was called Goblin Gulch or something like that. And, you know, it's in behind Hurricane Ridge over there, and I haven't heard anybody ever talk about going over there. That's kind of odd. There's a lot of places like that.
One of them not very far from here, Ape Canyon, near Ape Cave. And, of course, there's a famous old story from Ape Canyon. What do you make of that story? And specifically, what strikes me about that story, and some of the things I've heard about the St. Helens area in general, is that there's a lot of aggressive behavior in the stories and in the accounts. Do you think that is overblown? Do you think it's true, or what do you make of that?
The aggressive behavior. Well, I think each instance has to be evaluated on its own. And the Ape Canyon 1924 one was never explained if they were using dynamite. If they were, maybe they were disturbing these animals. I don't know. I think, like I said before, it was common practice for anybody to see something strange to shoot first and ask questions later. So they would shoot at this animal, and when they killed one, they said that it fell over the canyon. Well, I've been up to that canyon. Anything that falls over that is not going to fall to the bottom and disappear. It's going to get hung up on the side. But the side is pretty inaccessible, especially back in 1924. My theory is that the reason they didn't find bones is because it's still up on the side of the mountain, on the side of the Ape Canyon rim. And those bones may still be there, or they may have just disintegrated and fallen one by one.
Do you think there's anything to this idea that, and maybe it's just my idea, I don't know. Maybe now that I think about it, I don't think I've read this anywhere. But do you think there's anything to this idea that based on these stories, that the animals in this part of the country are more aggressive than their California neighbors, or not?
Well, a long time ago, the only aggressive areas that were really talked about was the Nahanni River in British Columbia, Headless Valley. All the other places, people were scared of these things, but as far as aggressive behavior, they were rare. You know, Ape Canyon was rare, Teddy Roosevelt's story was rare. Most of them were fleeting glances of these animals running off in fright. I don't know. I've been out with a lot of people, and there's been some people that, they hear something at night, and like right behind us there's some woods. They hear something there, and they quickly jump up and jump into the woods and poke themselves in the eye or something, you know. That's an aggressive behavior. Yeah. Maybe there's a lot of more aggressive Bigfoot hunters now.
Anything else?
What do you think about the Headless Canyon story? I mean, would they climb path it? I mean, that's frightening.
Yeah. Yeah, there was.
What is the Headless Canyon story for the listeners who have never heard of that story?
Headless Valley.
Headless Valley, sorry.
Well, there's a video about the upper Nahanni River. It had a nickname of the Headless Valley because some miners went in there. They were brothers, and the Royal Mounted Police went in when they heard that there was disturbances, and when they went in there, they found the bodies of these brothers, and they were headless. And the Indians, they attributed it to a lost Indian tribe in the valley that would cut off intruders' heads. And later on, that proved out to be false. There was no Indians in there. But there was a lot of other people that went in, and they mysteriously died too. But there wasn't, I think it was only those two that lost their heads.
I'm surprised they ruled out suicide pact that for the two brothers. That might be something worth following up.
It was in the 1800s or something like that. I mean, a suicide pact? What are you talking about?
Yeah, that's right. I don't know. I'm just, thinking outside the box over here.
If I had one specific spot anywhere in the Pacific Northwest to go, would probably be the BC coast because it's so remote. It's a perfect place for animals to come down and get clams, oysters, and then their tracks are wiped out by the tide. Yeah. And that's where Bob Titmus went a lot and found some really good tracks and saw, I think he had several sightings himself. He never wrote anything. It was really unfortunate that he never wrote anything about all of this, but that's the place I think I would go. I think that would be a really good trip.
What's your take on this, or do you have a take on whether or not the population of Sasquatch is increasing, decreasing, staying the same? Do you think that you can make a call on that with what we know?
No, I don't. What I think is happening is, maybe this is strange, but in all the history, I think there's more Bigfoot researchers now than there ever has been. And there's not enough Bigfoot sightings to go around. Now, back in the, when it first started, there was only four researchers. And take all the sightings that are coming in now and divide it up with those four, it's probably the same amount. So I really don't think that they're decreasing. I think there's a lot of people that are not saying anything. Like, my relatives, my grandfather claimed to have had one on his property over in Bremerton. And my brother just, this is kind of, I never told this story. This is recent. My brother is an elk hunter, and he hunts with bow, and he has a partner, and they went over to Natchez, which is near Yakima, and they go up on this ridge. They hunt there every year, and they were sitting around a campfire like us right now, but it was a little more dense around their campfire with brush, tall brush. There's more trees here than there. I don't know what they were doing. I think they were just talking or something like that, and then all of a sudden there was this loud screaming like an ape that was running right past their camp. And the brush was just popping and moving really quick. And they jumped up and grabbed their flashlights and shone it over there. And then they thought, well, that was strange. Must have been a sick bear or something. It made really strange noise. They never heard that noise before. And they've been doing this a long time. The next day they went out on their hunt. And my brother goes high and his partner goes low. And they try to spook one to the other. And they got to this rock slide. I don't know if it was a rock slide or a rock scree, one of the two. And my brother knew that the deer and elk would not go into that, so he went in there to see if he could just hide and one would walk by. So he got up in there and he found a flat spot, and it turned out to be a nest. And it was these sticks from all these fir trees. It was broken. They were broken off, and they were about a foot in length, and they were just laid down, and it was about 12 feet across, and there was skulls left in there of calves, of elk and deer. And so he was going to take me up there last weekend, but he couldn't make the trip, and so I went to Goat Rocks instead. But I'm going to go up there because he says it's still there. And they brought the skulls home. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, you're pretty grumpy. Bigfoot sitting up there. I want to know what happened to the skull collection.
Well, that's really what it is. I don't know. At first, I thought it was an eagle nest. But, when he said that there were skulls, that sort of threw me off. So I don't know what it was.
No other bones, just the skulls?
Yeah, just the skulls.
Yeah, it's one of those Headless Valley guys. Well, I want to thank you very much for sitting down. I'm noticing that we've gone for a while now, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you tonight.
Oh, thanks. It was fun. It really was.
Thanks a lot.
In today's community of Bigfoot enthusiasts, I believe it's necessary to really get to know the people behind the words. Whether those words are published in books, recorded in documentaries, or written on internet forums, before making assumptions regarding their motivation or value to the cause. We don't all need to agree on all aspects of research into this mystery, and we never will, but I think it's absolutely critical that we understand the hard work being performed by like-minded people every day. In my opinion, eventual acceptance of this animal by the mainstream will for a large part be due to the dedication of researchers like Rick Knoll. I'd like to thank Jerry Riedel and John Witherspoon and all the others who helped make my trip and this podcast a success.